Now, we might ask the question, why would we have a holy day dedicated to Satan the devil? Why would we do something like that? And how can you call this a feast day when we're fasting? Not exactly the kind of feast we would all design for ourselves, yet it's called a feast day, a holy day, yet here we are fasting. Well, God's holy days, as we know, are a vital outline of his plan. It gives us an understanding that simply we'd have no way of knowing what this is all about and where we're going. It would be guesswork, as most do. But the holy days are an outline of his plan, and Satan the devil is a huge factor in that overall plan. Even at the end of the millennium, there's a vital event that takes place where he's loosed for a little period of time and impacts the world very dramatically once again. So he's a huge part of God's purpose and his plan, beginning all the way back, as we know, in the book of Genesis. Well, this is not really a holy day about Satan. That isn't the intent of it. It's not a holy day about Satan specifically. It's a holy day about reconciliation and his role in that, how he comes into play with reconciling mankind to God, and you might say healing the breach that took place in the Garden of Eden when man was put out of the garden, symbolically separated from God, no longer having the ability to simply interact with God, as was originally the plan when God created Adam and Eve. That's restored to the church. And that's something that's vital for us to contemplate at times, that we have that ability, as it says, to come to the throne of God and actually contact the Creator God. Others do not have that right. The Apostle Paul said, well, we have an altar we go to that they have no right to. That comes through, of course, repentance and baptism and receiving of God's Spirit. Let's read 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 18. I'm hoping I'm not going to have to clear my throat too often. I have still have a little tickle remaining from that cold that lingered for a while, and a little drier today. I feel like I haven't had anything to drink all day. They've left me nothing up here either. Hopefully that won't be distracting to you. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 18, and all things are of God, who's reconciled us to himself. That's only valid for the church, being reconciled back to God, where we actually can come to God and he allows us to come into his presence and to speak with him, which, of course, Christ made possible. He's given us the ministry of reconciliation. That's what the Day of Atonement focuses on, not a holy day to Satan. It's a holy day about reconciliation and the steps that are necessary to do that. So God's intent is to provide a way where mankind can be reconciled to him after being cast out of the Garden of Eden. And that terrible separation that took place back in, and you can read Genesis chapter 3, of course, and see all that took place there. So let's be reminded of the meaning and then take a look at Satan's role in God's plan. We'll do that here this afternoon. In Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 5, Hebrews 8 and verse 5, the Apostle Paul in the book of Hebrews in chapter 8 and 9 gives a lot of information about what we're contemplating here this afternoon. It says they, it means the ones that were worshiping at the tabernacle, the ones going through the ritual, the sacrificing, and all of that that took place in ancient Israel. They that worshiped served at a place that is a pattern. It's a shadow of what is in heaven. It represented something. That was just a tent, they sometimes called it, and the curtain and the holy place and everything God had them construct. But it's a very important shadow of something much more vital and spiritual. When Moses was about to make the tabernacle, God said, just make it any old way you want. Here's a basic outline, just whatever comes to your mind. Well, not at all. When Moses was about to make the tabernacle, God warned him, Be sure to make everything based on the plan I showed you in the mountain. You follow this precisely. These are important indicators and clues to my overall plan. It's a physical introduction to the spiritual or the heavenly. Well, a ceremony took place in that tabernacle once every year that was extremely vital and important to ancient Israel. If the high priest did not perform that ceremony, God would remove his presence from Israel. So something took place within the Holy of Holies involving the high priest. This was a very, very momentous time for Israel and very vital, very solemn, because they knew it would be very important to them. If God did not accept the high priest and his sacrifice on that Day of Atonement, they had no future. God's presence would remove from on top of the Holy of Holies and that tabernacle. But if God accepted it, then his presence remained and they were relieved for another year. Leviticus chapter 16, we should look at a few verses here. We turn here at least on this time of year, once a year. Leviticus chapter 16, we won't go into all of the details. We'll pick it up in verse 5 of chapter 16. Here, speaking of the high priest in verse 5 of Leviticus 16, he's going to take of the congregation of the children of Israel, not one, but two kids of the goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. And Aaron shall offer his bullock of the sin offering, which is for himself. You, Aaron, offer something for yourself first, and that way I'll allow you to come forward on behalf of the rest of the congregation. So he had to, in a sense, purify himself first. And then in verse 7, and he shall take of the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and he shall cast lots upon the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for the goat that would escape, or the margin has Azazel. We know that represents the devil. Satan, the devil. And Aaron shall bring the goat upon the Lord's lot, fell, and offer him for a sin offering. So one was to be offered, put to death, slain like all of the other sacrifices, and that was to represent the sacrifice of Christ. This is a part of the steps of reconciling man to God, and what we have to do in order to be at one with God. So there had to be a sacrifice which Christ fulfilled. So that's what verse 9 says. And it said in verse 8 that he would cast lots upon the two goats. Why didn't God just say, well, look the two goats over, and whichever one looks better to you, we'll use that for the sin offering. That would represent Christ. Look them over, whichever's the better of the two, go ahead and do that. Well, I don't know the exact reasons God does what he does, but we're not able to recognize Satan and his strategies. We can't tell the difference between false religion and true religion, between real spirituality and a false spirit. Satan is that crafty, that deceptive. Using our own human reasoning, we would end up, as the vast majority of the world does, going, even following religion and spirituality, and going in a completely wrong direction, being confused about what is spiritual and what isn't. So maybe that's part of what it pictures here. God says, cast lots, I'll tell you which represents Christ, which would represent the Azazel. You won't be able to pick it yourself or figure it out. At least there's that lesson for us. And that certainly is very accurate. Without God's Spirit and his help, Satan would be able to lead us in a direction that he would want us to go. He would fool us every time. Well, skipping on down to verse 10, or going to verse 10, the goat on which the lot fell to be the escape goat shall be presented, not killed and put to death, but alive before the Lord to make an atonement with him and to let him go for a scapegoat into the wilderness. So that one was not to be killed. And as we see in verse 20, after the instructions, it gives more detail about what Aaron was to do. And then it says, and when he has made an end of reconciling the holy place and the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar, he's going to bring the live goat. And Aaron would lay both his hands upon the head of the live goat. Very unusual ceremony. You never do this any other time. Now he's placing his hands upon the goat, confessing over him all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions and all their sins, putting them upon the head of the goat, and shall send him away by the hand of a fit man into the wilderness. And the goat shall bear upon him all their iniquities in the land not inhabited. He shall go, let go the goat in the wilderness. Very strange ceremony. At least very unusual. Lays his hands, confesses on this particular goat all the iniquities of the children of Israel, and now he lets it go. Where does he let it go? Well, into lush pasture, where it just feeds and gets fat. No, out into the wilderness, out into somewhere that's barren. Another clue as to why we feel this represents Satan the devil. I'd like to go to Isaiah chapter 13 and read a few verses. I think this ties in with what Satan is all about and maybe a little bit of what we read about this goat going into the wilderness. In Isaiah chapter 13, the topic is Babylon or Babylon the Great. We know there was a physical Babylon, but that represented the spiritual Babylon the Great. The book of Revelation talks about Babylon, Babylon falling in Revelation chapter 18. And notice a few things here that it states about Babylon. We'll go down to verse 19. It says, in Babylon, the glory of the kingdoms, the beauty of the Babylonians. We know there's a Babylonian mystery religion called Babylon the Great, which has deceived the whole world. So here's this kingdom, the beauty of the Chaldeans' excellency shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. So there's going to be the physical fall of Babylon and the fall of Babylon the Great. Well, who's behind Babylon the Great and the spiritual wickedness? It's never going to be inhabited. Neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch his tent there. Neither shall the shepherds make their fold there. And that's been fulfilled in prophecy. It goes on to say something curious, but wild beasts of the desert shall lie there. It doesn't say it's going to grow up into be a lush land and all kinds of vegetation and plenty of water and all of that. Wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, kind of howling animals, mournfully howling. A very negative picture. An owl shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there. A satyr, you'll recall from mythology, was a half-man, half-goat. A goat from the waist on back, and a man, but yet he had horns. Very devil-like, satanic-like. And here's this reference here in this wilderness, kind of an eerie kind of a wilderness where Babylon has fallen. And these doleful, sad creatures are roaming around in the desert. Kind of like the picture you got in Leviticus 16. And just the kind of environment that the devil would enjoy. Something dirty, something wasteful, something dry. So kind of creepy kind of creatures. It kind of gives you, some of this is the theme of Halloween. All of these creatures and ghosts and skeletons and scary animals and dark colors, black and orange, and all of these things that represent something, as even history tells you, represents the devil. You get a certain picture. God's way is clean. It's bright. It's beautiful. It's lush. It's the world tomorrow. Satan's world is dry and desert-like. That's where this goat is sent. Send him out into the wilderness and dwell there. So I think there's very interesting terminology and symbolism that comes into this day. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. The sins of the people were placed on the head of this goat through Aaron and his ceremony. So Satan is held responsible in a way for what the condition of mankind is. He's the one that approached Eve in the garden to deceive her, to lie to her. So it's partly his doing. She had a choice to make, as did Adam, but it's partly his doing. How does he do this? How is this accomplished? How does the devil work? 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 11, the Apostle Paul warns us we better be on guard lest Satan should get an advantage, get an upper hand, get the upper hand in our heart, in our mind. We're not ignorant of his devices. Well, at times we are. We learn. But generally, we're not ignorant of how he functions, how he operates. What do you mean is devices? What are those devices of the devil? Well, he works, I'll characterize it, in two ways, fundamentally. You know, we've heard about there are two great commandments, and all the law is dependent or rests upon the two great commands, love God and love your neighbor. And everything else kind of follows those two fundamental pillars. Well, in the same way, we can look at the scriptures and say Satan functions in two separate, distinct, yet related ways. First of all, Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2. What are his devices? How does he function? How does he work? How is he able to accomplish what he does? Speaking to the church, he tells all of us in the past, we walked according to a certain tune, you might say, traveled to a beat of a different drum. We're all walking a certain way. We had a different path, but fundamentally, it wasn't the Spirit of God leading us there. If we've come out of the world, then at times past, we walked according to the course of the world. What's the world doing? What are they into? What's popular? What's trendy? And that was all, according to the Apostle Paul, according to the prince who has a certain amount of power in the air. It's a spirit that works in the children of disobedience. Remember, we were in 2 Corinthians, so I'll read this to you. Probably left there in verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 2. Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 12. It says, now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit of God. The scriptures say that there's a God of the world, a spirit that works in the children of disobedience, a spirit that has power in the air, the best way to describe it. It's a spirit in the world. What do you mean by that? A spirit in the world. Is it just kind of percolate out of the ground or what? You know, I don't know if they do so much here. I haven't heard that much. But in the north, in different places that we've lived, if you're buying a house, you always have an inspection for radon gas. Because that, in certain sections of the country, it comes up out of the ground. And if it gets in your home, it can be very, very detrimental. And so you test for that. Is this house built over an area where there's radon gas? And you have to take steps if it is, and there's various things that have to be done, and you test for that. I don't hear that too much around here, but where is this spirit of the world? Is it just coming up out of the ground? Well, no. Satan's spirit is in the world. You could, in this day and age, compare it to a cell phone or a Wi-Fi signal. Excuse me. Cell phones and Wi-Fi signals, they're all around. Permeating this building, Wi-Fi signal in here, and he's the prince of the power of the air. There's a certain amount of influence that's just there. It's in the world. He has control of that. He can emanate that to one degree or another. Some of you have AT&T cell phones like I do, and you can go, I think Starbucks is one. You'll have an AT&T hotspot where you can pick up the free Wi-Fi. If you're an AT&T customer, well, they may have some contract with Facebook. Go in there, use the Wi-Fi, and pick it right up. Well, I suppose we could say by analogy that Satan's spirit is in the world. It's there, but he probably has undoubtedly some hot spots as well, where that influence, that spirit, that attitude, that negativity, that unrighteousness, that negativity would be much, much stronger. Maybe we'd say bars, strip clubs, maybe even places like Vegas, maybe more there than other places, porn shops, Bourbon Street, New Orleans. Have you ever been down there? You call them hot spots because it's that kind of spirit, that kind of sensuality or negativity or something evil is there, more prevalent. Sometimes you can even kind of feel like you sense something is evil here. It's negative. It's not beautiful. It's not something of God's spirit. So maybe there's kind of hot spots, but whatever, there's a spirit that permeates the air. He's a prince of the power of the air. Look at Matthew chapter 4, verse 3. Satan uses that spirit to tempt us. Now here it's more of a personal, which we'll see in a moment. It says now in Matthew 4, 3, when the tempter came, Satan's spirit tends to impact our mind in a kind of temptation. Now, let's turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 18 and see something interesting here. 2 Chronicles 18. And in verse 19, this is an interesting interaction here between God and a spirit. 2 Chronicles 18, verse 19. So now the Lord said, now who can go and entice Ahab, the king of Israel, so that he goes up and so that he'll then fall at Ramoth-Gilead? How can we get the king to do that? Well, no, what's the best way to go about this, I wonder? How can we, God's kind of pondering. What can we do? And one of the angels around his throne apparently spoke after this man. Well, I got a good idea. Why don't we try this? Why don't we try something else? One spoke after this manner and then another after that manner. And I got a good idea. Maybe if we do this or that or the other thing. Well, then there came out a spirit and stood before the Lord and said, I'll entice him. And the Lord said, well, how are you going to go about doing that? And he said, I'll go out, I'll be a lying spirit in the mouth of all of his false prophets. Probably a false spirit too. I'll go in and I'll be a lying spirit in the mouth of his false prophets. They might even not even know they're lying. And God said, I think that'll work. Go ahead and entice him, and you shall also prevail. Go out and do even as you've decided. We'll go with that plan. I'll entice him. I'll kind of tempt him. I'll be a voice in the false prophets, and that will lead him. What they tell him will be appealing to him. It'll sound good to him. And then he'll follow that direction. Then he'll go up and he'll fall at Ramoth-Gilead. That's how we'll get it done. But notice the methodology. I'll entice him. That's how Satan's spirit works in the children of disobedience. There's a kind of enticing. There's a playing on our desires and our needs and the things that we want, the things that we see. There's an enticement that tends to draw you towards something. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. We're examining how Satan relates to this specific day and what a huge difference it makes once this day is fulfilled. The Apostle Paul had to warn the church in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3. He said, I'm worried, I'm fearful, I'm really concerned, lest by any means, just like the serpent beguiled Eve. Well, the serpent's not going to come and talk to the people in the church. End up, next thing you know, somebody said, well, there's some serpent started talking to me the other day. No, he didn't mean that. But in the same way that the serpent beguiled Eve through a subtlety, a false spirituality, a false spirit, or whatever, so your minds would be corrupted from the simplicity that's in Christ. I'm concerned about that. He's very crafty. He has a way of enticing. You have to be sharp. You have to be alert. You have to be on guard. You have to be aware of those things. God's Spirit has to sort of speak to you or bring something to your mind and your conscience that would tell you, that would alert you. So the first point, I mentioned there were two. The first one is that there's a broadcast out there. Anybody can pick it up. It's out there, always available. There's a broadcast that's picked up by humans, and they don't even realize it. They don't know something's always trying to lead them, suggesting we think a certain way, promoting, luring us into certain attitudes and thoughts and ideas. It's just there. It's everywhere. And like I say, undoubtedly, there are hot spots where it would be stronger because of the environment. Those are the places we avoid. Stay away. Not only an environment, but maybe a certain type of people with certain attitudes or practices. They might be hot spots too. So there's a broadcast, the prince of the power of the air. But there's something more. There's a second part. And it's not just something that's generalized and it's out there and anybody can pick up on it. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. Now we see it's something more specific, more individualized, not a general spirit, the spirit of the world that the prince of the power of the air is always promoting. But now it says, through Peter, 1 Peter 5:8, be alert, be vigilant, sober. Your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, is not just putting out a broadcast you might come across, might tune in, but he's actually figuratively walking about looking for something specifically. He's walking around, not just somewhere, and he's got this tower with this signal going out. He's actually on the move, and he's looking, seeking to be attracted towards something. What can I find? And, of course, the demons would be the same. So it's not just a signal infusing the air, but Satan, you might say, trolling and seeing if he can find an opportunity most assuredly or keenly where God's people are. That's where he would really like to work. This is where an individual's then can, you might say, invite attention. Not just a spirit, but invite the one that's roaming around seeking who he might influence. Now, we've all heard, I'm sure, with the nature shows today, and these all of these shows about sharks are very popular. They're on all the time. But they say that, incredibly, certain types of sharks, that you could have an Olympic-sized swimming pool, take one drop of blood, and that shark is going to pick up on it. One drop in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and the shark senses there's something in the water, and he's looking for it. That's maybe a good analogy for what the devil would be like, according to Peter, roaming around looking to pick up on something. What can I pick up on and then exacerbate or add to it. Pick up something negative, something carnal, something improper, something vain, something hateful, something a lustful spirit, some bitterness. What can I pick up on? He'll spot it. He'll sense it. And he's roaming around, and if there's something, well, then he'll go for it. He'll be attracted to it. Seems to be what Peter's saying. So it's a dual action, a broadcast, but also an active working. He's attracted to that spirit, and then he tries to intensify the situation. Now, most of you will recall in Mr. Armstrong's autobiography, this would be on volume 1, page 410, and he was talking about his early ministry and all the different things he ran into. He came in contact with the Stanbury, Missouri, the Church of God, and Elder Duggar, and had some interaction with them, and he's starting to come into the church and getting his feet wet, but had a lot of things to learn and so on. He relates this one story. So let me read this to you from page 410. It was always an interesting, it kind of shows his personality. This wouldn't be for everybody to do or to use wisdom on. But he says, the dispute over Stanbury politics, politics in the church at Stanbury, in the Church of God, and specifically Elder Duggar's personal fitness and integrity waxed more and more heated in this particular meeting that they were all in. One tall man who weighed considerably over 200 pounds and was a leader spoke of dirty politics and called Elder Duggar a ward healer, which is kind of a vote seeker, a politician. Obviously a slam on any spiritually minded person. Well, an equally vociferous man on the other side of the dispute rose to defend the honor of Mr. Duggar. Words flamed hotter and hotter. Each side was sincere and roused. And you've probably been. I've been in things where you have a meeting and somebody speaks out and, well, that gets to you, and somebody else stands up and now they're a little louder. Then it starts getting heated and people begin shouting and things start to break down and begin. Emotions get stirred up and anger. So he says, words flamed hotter and hotter, each side sincere in roused earnest. Under the intense pressure, tempers were flaring. I became afraid it was going to be settled or unsettled by fists. At that instant, I rose and in a loud but calm voice asked if I might say a word. Since I was a guest, they didn't refuse. Brethren, I said, you all know how is recorded in the first chapter of Job, when the sons of God came together, Satan came also. You also know how in the 12th chapter of Revelation we are told that the people Satan is most angry with are those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. That means us. Satan is here. He's stirring up rage and anger in our hearts. I'm going to drop to my knees right now and ask God Almighty to cast Satan out of this house. All of you who wish may kneel with me and pray silently. Without another word, I quickly dropped to my knees beside my chair and began asking God to rebuke Satan and this controversial spirit that was rousing these men to anger and to drive Satan from our presence and to give us peace and love. Well, when I arose, there were some wet eyes, but there were no angry voices. These people were sincere. They simply believed what they believed and had allowed themselves to be caught off guard and roused to anger. I wouldn't recommend everybody just drop to their knees in all of these circumstances, but what an interesting response he had. And he recognized or sensed this is getting out of hand. There's a spirit that's in the air, and maybe even individually something now adding to all of this. It wasn't, as he said, a spirit of peace and kindness. And so after that prayer, it calmed down. Was that just a psychological ploy? Or was there really something there? And once people got their minds away from that, it couldn't work anymore in the same way. It just couldn't make any inroads. Doesn't the scriptures say to resist the devil, he'll flee? So this is a form of resistance. We're to ask God, God in the same way, protect us from a wrong spirit, protect our mind. So I say we feel we're in a battle of one type or another. God, help me, protect me. We're not trying to be overly superstitious about this. As Mr. DeHart said, we don't see the devil behind every bush. Every time we have a flat tire, oh, there's the devil again. We don't go to that extreme, but we don't neglect nor discard what we find revealed in the scriptures either. So I think that's a good thought, a good example that he points out, and it calmed down. And they weren't perfect people after that. There's a different spirit. Could have gotten way out of hand. As he said, come to fists. We've all seen things break down. Interesting lesson there. So what does Satan look to exploit? Just a couple few things. There's obviously a whole long list. What does he look to exploit? He will look for discouragement and despair. Discouragement and despair. Who doesn't have it in their lives? We'll get discouraged over something. Everything doesn't go right. Feel despair. Feel neglected. Feel abandoned, unblessed. And that's certainly something that he would be attracted to as we ponder that. Now, didn't we hear in the sermonette about, you get into too much self-pity and your mind is only on yourself. You need to ask God, help me to come out of that. Not easy to do. Let's read a couple psalms there for this purpose. Psalm 34. In Psalm 34, verse 18, the Lord is near to the brokenhearted. I've come to heal the brokenhearted. The Lord is near the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. You're just crushed in spirit. That's the world, the age in which we live. We'll be discouraged. There'll be despair. We'll feel crushed. The Lord's near to the brokenhearted, saves the crushed in spirit, where the devil's spirit broadcast is going to try to feed that. That's the battle. Psalm 55, verse 22. Psalm 55, 22. I didn't write down the translation. I don't think it's the King James. But Psalm 55, 22 says, give your burdens to the Lord, and he will take care of you. Cast your care upon him. We have that in the New Testament. Give your burdens to the Lord. He will take care of you. He will not permit the godly to slip and fall. He will not permit the godly to slip and fall as long as the godly are still desirous of being godly. If you want to forget that and depart from that, well, then that's another story. If we're still committed to being godly, he won't allow us to slip and fall, meaning permanently. We all fall temporarily. Well, those are reassuring scriptures. Satan likes to deal with discouragement, despair, disappointment. And we are disappointed at things. Everything doesn't go right. What else does he work with? Doubt and fear. Who doesn't have that? Doubtful, fearful. We have a very encouraging song. We all have doubts and fears. Read a couple more psalms. Psalm 31. Psalm 31 and verse 22. Satan likes to work with doubts and fear. Verse 22 says, I said in my haste, I am cut off from before your eyes. Nevertheless, you heard the voice of my supplication when I cried unto you. I said in my haste, my initial thought was, I'm abandoned. It's over. I'm alone. I'm fearful. I'm doubtful. I said in my haste, I'm cut off from your eye. Nevertheless, you heard the voice of my supplication when I cried. So we do have to go to God. I feel cut off. I feel abandoned. I feel fearful. It says he hears. You heard my cry. That's his promise. And one more in Psalm 50. Psalm 50. These are some of his devices. There are many, many others. Just highlighting a few things that underscore the meaning of the day and how it's a part of God's plan. In verse 15 of Psalm 50, "And call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me." That's one of the ways that we do glorify God. We have the doubt, we have the natural fear or the discouragement, and he said, call upon me, and it's only after you're able to do that, then you're able to glorify God. And, well, I'm telling you, if you call upon God, he'll help you. He'll lift you up. He'll deliver you. You wouldn't know that if you weren't in the doubtful or fearful set of circumstances first. That's why he allows that, but it's only temporary. And finally, a third example would be discord. Saw that in that meeting that we read from the autobiography. Ephesians 4 and verse 3. Ephesians 4 and verse 3. This is speaking of unity in Ephesians 4, and it says in verse 3, endeavoring to keep the unity, working at keeping unity. You don't have unity when we just all relax and let go. You have to endeavor to keep unity. There's always going to be things that come up that try to work against a unity, whether it's in the family, among friends, in a school, a club, a church, what have you. We're peacemakers. So we have to endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. I'll read to you Proverbs 6. You can mark it down. It's verse 16. You heard these things before. Proverbs 6 and verse 16. Satan loves to work through discord, some kind of competition or some type of one person against another, or feelings along those lines. Proverbs 6:16 says, "These six things the Lord hates." Yeah, as a matter of fact, there's seven. Well, what are those that are an abomination to him? Proverbs 6:16. Well, a proud look. You walk around all proud. Heard that in the sermonettes. Lucifer was very proud. Proud of his beauty. Felt he belonged in God's position. God hates a proud look. Walking around, prancing around, all prideful. Thinking we're better than somebody else. A proud look, he hates a lying tongue. Hands that shed innocent blood. Some innocent person paying some penalty. A heart that's trying to devise some wicked things. That's scheming. Deceitfulness. Feet, of course, that are swift to run to mischief. Like to get into trouble. Somebody that speaks lies. And that sows discord among the righteous people. Some kind of discord. Disruption. Maybe introducing doubt or fear or whatever. Discouragement. Somebody that's sowing that, promoting that, creating doubt, affecting the little ones. Or long-time ones, for that matter. Well, there's two solutions. I mentioned there were two methods that the devil uses. So I've got two solutions to the devil's influence. Two fundamental solutions. James 4, verse 7. James 4 and verse 7. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. And we do that in prayer, as I mentioned. What's the solution to the devil? His influence, his broadcast, is maybe being attracted to something he sees us doing. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist that. and he will tend to leave. I can't do my work here. That's what they were doing in that meeting through the prayer. He'll flee from you. So draw closer to God. God will be close to you. Clean up your hands if there's something you're doing you know that you shouldn't be doing. Try to purify your heart. All of these things counteract the spirit in the world. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be afflicted, mourn, weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, where you're not just frivolously silly. Doesn't mean you have to always be sad and mourning. But your joy to heaviness. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he'll lift you up. Satan is proud when we humble ourselves before God. Then he lifts us up. Verse 6 of that same chapter, he gives more grace, which is his favor, which we don't earn. Wherefore, he says, God resists the proud, but he'll give grace to the ones that are humble before him, not haughty or better than somebody else, or their mind on themselves, as we heard earlier. That's one reason we're fasting today. This is a day that's speaking about the devil's role in God's plan, the solution to reconciliation, and what has to be done with respect to him. He's not removed yet. We have to resist. We have to be humble. This is why we're fasting today. Lucifer is filled with pride, or he was, and the devil is. He was filled with pride, as I mentioned before. Think about how pleased God is today. All of his people, wherever they are, around the world, afflicting their soul in the physical fasting, but it's an exercise in humility. Nobody does that voluntarily just because they enjoy it. So he's seeing his people around the world. It has to be, as the scriptures sometimes say, a sweet savor to God. Here's all these people humbling themselves, afflicting themselves. If it's done for the right reason, with the right heart, that has to be pleasing to God, and it has to be grating on the devil. Doesn't like to see that. Doesn't like to see us in a holy convocation or listening to a message or the truth and taking it in. That fortifies us. Doesn't want that. Wants us weak. So that's the first solution, humility, going to God. The second we read, and I'll read it again in Revelation chapter 20, just a couple more verses here in wrapping this thought up today. Revelation chapter 20, this is the second solution. God wants to work with all of mankind in a major way during the millennium. He wants there to be a contrast to this age. The first fruits have had to make it through this age, but the vast majority will be in the millennium or second resurrection, and there won't be a Satan, and that's where we find in Revelation 20, once again, an angel coming down having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He lays hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and puts him to death. Oh, no, we don't see that in the scripture either. Now he's bound for 1,000 years. Wasn't put to death in Leviticus chapter 16 earlier either. So no Satan during the millennium. The millennium is a time of peace. It's a time of brightness, light, healthiness, cleanliness. Not the negativity. At least not in the same way. People will still be people. But no Satan, no satanic Wi-Fi or cell phone signal. Won't be there. Nobody roaming around to make a situation worse when people do what humans always do. That's the second solution. Well, Christians are at one with God now through repentance and baptism. We go to the throne of God and contact our Creator. The church has a ministry of reconciliation to those to whom God is calling. God wants the whole world to be at peace during the 1,000 years. So Christ can return all he wants, but if the devil is not taken out of the way, you're not going to have a world at one. Not going to happen. That next step in God's plan of Satan, as we read here in chapter 20, has to take place. So that spirit will not be there to do its work. So we're told to put on the whole armor of God. We won't read that. You know that Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12, we're told to be on guard, to be watchful, to have our antenna up for the negative, the false religion, false spirit of the devil. Like, again, we heard in the sermonette, something passed on for spirituality was a wrong concept, wrong principle. So that's our daily calling. Jesus said in John 14, verse 30, after this I will not say much to you because the ruler of the world comes. He has no power over me. The devil has no power over me. I have too much of God's spirit. Spirit without measure. He resisted the devil's temptations. Remember in Matthew chapter 4. The devil, the ruler of the world's coming. He has no power over me. Well, we don't have quite that same strength, but we have the solution. We know where to go. We know who gives us the victory. So this is our daily calling. God will not leave us or forsake us in the battle. We will be the ones instructing others in the millennium and in the second resurrection about the working of Satan and what that's all about, and preparing them for the end of the millennium when he's let loose for a little season. Let's conclude then in 1 John chapter 4, excuse me, and in verse 4, 1 John chapter 4, I'll just read this very comforting verse. 1 John chapter 4, you are of God, little children. You're called to God's way. We go to the throne of God. You are of God, little children, and have overcome them. If we're here, if we're going to the feast, observing the feast, living God's way, then we've overcome the world. We've come out of it. It's still a process, but we've come out of this world. We don't follow the world, what it's doing, what it's into. That's not what makes us tick. You are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world.